All right, we're back on the Hal Ginsberg Morning Show, and it's really I'm delighted to introduce to you Robert Scribler. He writes at Robert. There it is. I just called up because, Rob, I always get websites wrong, and I was like, oh, my gosh, is it robert.scribler.com or Robert Scribler Green Energy or some other? No, it's just Robert Scribler. That's a good name, robertscribler.com, and thank you so much for joining me.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, Hal. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, I found your website. I don't even remember where it was linked, and I really like, I mean, you write so well, beautifully, very, really for the layperson, I believe, at least it's understandable, and yet you have obviously a very deep reservoir of academic knowledge, of training. So tell us about that. I mean, how are you qualified, say, to, more than I am, for example, to opine on our environmental and energy crisis?
Well, my background is emerging threats. I started out as a force protection officer for the U.S. Navy as well as a military intelligence analyst, and then I moved to Jane's as a managing editor for a series of publications on emerging threats, and that included pretty much anything that would keep you awake at night, WMD, terrorism, climate change, resource depletion, anything in that bailiwick. And what my job was to develop a cadre of experts in these various fields so that we could then produce publications on the issues as they emerged.
All right, now, let me just jump in because we don't have that much time. I really want to get to the content as well. And at your site, you do describe yourself as scribbling for economic, social, and environmental justice. I would certainly argue those three cannot be separated, nor can racial justice either. I mean, they all one ball of wax. But your focus seems to be of late, I may have missed some articles, really on greenhouse gas emissions, on global warming. Am I right? And if so, why have you chosen, why do you believe that is the most emergent threat and thus most worthy of your attention at this time?
My opinion is that the issue of climate change, global warming, economic justice, and generally the future progress of humankind are linked. If you have a crisis like climate change that impacts the resource base so strongly as climate change, then you end up with a high risk of increasing poverty, of increasing displacement, increasing migration, and all of those crises greatly increase the risk of exploitation and poor treatment of individuals who are victimized as a result of this kind of crisis. So for me, climate change is an economic justice issue, is a social justice issue, and in my opinion is probably one of the most critical justice issues of our time, if we're looking at the potential for harm. And in my opinion, it's a deep, pervasive, underlying issue that is, well, for lack of a better term, is an environment not just of our, you know, ecological troubles, but it relates to our economic crises that are going on as it results to various different resource issues, particularly water, but moving forward, human habitation, land use, crops, as well as our access to critical things that are critical to just our survival as humans, including food. So it's not only a threat, it's not only something to look at and say, oh, well, we should be concerned about this, and we should look at it as a potential crisis that is ongoing, but we should also look at it in the sense of how do we help others that are inevitably going to be impacted by this crisis that we are causing.
You describe the emergent threat in near future terms, but would it be fair to say, Rob, that it's actually happening right now? and that we're facing accelerating problems, accelerating dislocations, displacements, and impoverishment as we move forward in time.
Absolutely. I mean, we've warmed the climate by 1 degree Celsius since the 1880s, and that might not sound like a lot, but in climate terms, that is substantial. Just as a comparison, the end of the last ice age, we warmed about 3.5 degrees Celsius. But that warming occurred over 10,000 years. We've warmed 1 degree Celsius over 135 years. So the pace of warming is 10 times at least that of the end of the last ice age. And that has dramatic impacts on how our climate is today, how the things we see in our climate today versus what we would see 100 years ago, 30 years ago. For example, for every 1 degree warming, you amplify the rate of evaporation and precipitation by 7%. So the rainfall events are more intense, the droughts are more intense, and that's just one impact. One of the articles I recently wrote was on climate dislocation due to extreme weather. And over the past 7 years alone, we've had 158 million people displaced worldwide as a result of extreme weather. And that impact is significantly greater than it was in the 1970s, for example. You're 60% more likely to be displaced by extreme weather now than you were then. And that is just, that's just one of the impacts that we see today.
That's a really interesting statistic, and I really appreciate the way you frame that. So the individual in America is more likely to see her or his life or his family's life negatively impacted in such a way that she has to move. She actually has to uproot her family and leave friends, leave people behind because of these the climate changes that we humans are causing. Is there any doubt, because you hear all the time, well, it used to be called global warming, but now it's climate change, so that proves it's a hoax. Because they couldn't even stick by their old name for it, or those emails prove that they created the IPCC, and these English scientists just were manipulating data to scare us. Is there anything at all to those arguments?
Those arguments are complete nonsense. If you climate change itself is an effect of global warming, so. If you look at global warming is the cause, climate change is the effect. So as you warm the climate, there are different changes, things that I call geophysical changes, in the way the Earth system works. So you have changes in the way the ocean environment functions, you have changes in the way the atmosphere functions, you have changes in the relationship between ice and the water and the air. So you have these massive and variant geophysical changes as a result of climate change. As a result of warming the climate, and then the changes that you see are climate change. So an example of that is a recent study by James Hansen that is now being circulated widely, and I encourage anyone who is willing to take a crack at scientific literature to read James Hansen's most recent paper, because it is, in my opinion, a seminal work. But what he looks at is how ice sheets change as a result of warming. And we're learning more and more as time goes by, and it's relatively a scary thing to look at, because what happens is as the ocean warms, it melts the glaciers where they contact the water. The glaciers melt and spread out this wedge, what I call a freshwater wedge, a wedge of fresh water at the surface of the ocean. What that does is it stops the ocean in that area from ventilating heat to the atmosphere. Now, what does that do? It has two effects. It cools the atmosphere locally, warms the ocean underneath that layer, and intensifies the melt of that glacier. Now, anyone living near one of those glaciers, say, you know, in England or Northern Europe, for example, in the case of Greenland, would experience temporarily, as a result of a large glacial melt, a cooling, which is ironically a result of overall global warming and the warming of the ocean system. What's happening is there's a heat exchange going on that is melting that glacier, changing the ocean environment, changing the environment above the ocean, and amplifying the melt in that glacier. And because of this effect, James Hansen thinks that it's possible that we could see upwards of 10 feet of sea level rise within the next 50 years due to what is called an amplifying feedback. And that the result of that is due to the fact that we are warming the Earth system as a whole. We are melting those glaciers, and causing those glaciers to melt results in a cascade of other effects that can be all lumped under climate change.
All right, Rob Scribler with us. He blogs, he writes, I shouldn't say blogs, his website is robertscribler.com, Scribbling for Environmental, Social, and Economic Justice, and explain to us how the, paradoxical effect of the melting of the glaciers due to global warming, it may create some increased surface ice, which actually leads to overall heating of the ocean underneath the ice, because the ocean doesn't ventilate as well, and therefore causes the waters in the ocean to heat up even more rapidly, and there are other factors as well. You can find that at robertscribler.com. Rob, is there reason to believe those who say, well, and I've, you know, some of the deniers, there's a guy down in University of Alabama who is self-described Christian, who is also a climatologist, and his name, for unfortunately, is, I've forgotten it for the moment. He's often cited by deniers. He actually has written that he believes the observed warming could be or is secondary to 50% of the observed warming is secondary to human activity, the other 50% natural factors, like, I guess, increased solar output. Even that 50%, I think, is very significant. I pointed that out to deniers. I say, look, the guy you quote as to support your claim that humans aren't burning the planet up says 50% of observed warming is doing. I give him the exact quotation. Is that a fair argument? Well, yeah, all right, maybe we're making things hotter, but there are other factors as well that also are contributing to this increased temperature on Earth.
Well, there are no other factors in the case of the sun. The sun itself is in a period of declining solar activity. The most recent solar minimum was the lowest solar minimum on record. So that particular attribution to natural variability holds no water. Now, natural variability does have an effect on climate, absolutely. But, well, let's see. One scientist recently described this very well, and I can't remember his name, but it's, in my opinion, a perfect allegory. Global warming itself, by human factors, is like putting us on an up escalator as far as energy, heat energy in the Earth system is involved. And natural variability itself, the responses of climate in the natural system, is like a person standing on the escalator, which is going up, jumping up and down. So yes, the climate system itself has this own internal variability, which cycles primarily with El Nino cycles. The sun itself has a very small influence due to its variability. The change at the top of the atmosphere is very small when you compare it to the effect of human greenhouse gas emissions. So the change that you see due to natural variability, though it may swing a bit, is in the context of overall human increase in heat energy accumulation in the Earth system. So without like large responses from systems like glaciers, we would see extreme warming.
A lot of the warming we don't feel ourselves, because it's the oceans where we don't spend any time. Most of us aren't in the oceans. The fish the fish notice it, but not humans generally. All right, we've got to move on. I got so much to cover. We're in full swing political season. Hillary Clinton has a 3-minute, very professionally, slickly produced video, Stand for Reality. She points out how Republicans are in denial. She wants 100% solar panel penetration in terms of homes in America by 2027. Of course, she'd be out of office in any event. We can't judge her. We can't hold her to that standard in any event if we're going to try to reelect her. Are you heartened by that? Do you think she is a plausible champion of a clean, green energy future, Rob?
Well, I'll be honest. On this particular issue, I am not an expert. I can only speak for my opinion. And when it comes to Hillary Clinton, I'm a bit concerned due to, from a liberal standpoint and looking at her as her position in the Democratic Party as it has been traditionally, she's been more, on the moderate to conservative side and has had some instances where, it seems a disturbingly close relationship to fossil fuels and overall neoliberal kind of bent to her politics. My opinion is that, her campaigning on the issue of climate change is a very good thing. For example, if we look back at Obama in 2012, no one was talking about climate change. No one was talking about the issue. No one would touch it. So it's a big step forward for Hillary to be promoting solar, especially putting a solar panel on every roof by 2027. If such a policy were to emerge, I would support it wholeheartedly. That would be a fantastic policy. Her failure to talk out on issues like Keystone XL, things of that nature, that's cause for some concern.
Doesn't that to you? I don't. And you said you don't like, you don't feel as comfortable on this issue because you're not an expert, at least in terms of solar panels versus windmills and the like. I assume is what you're referring to. Don't let that bother you. I speak out on every issue, and I'd hardly, maybe on law once I was an expert. Everything else, I'm kind of a dilettante. It doesn't keep me from opining loudly and table thumping. So feel free to do the same thing as my point, Rob.
Well, as far as, I think I have a decent knowledge of solar panels versus wind, solar panels versus, say, for example, fossil fuels. I just don't consider myself to be an expert in the political realm.
I see. Well, then tell us about that. Solar power versus wind versus tidal energy, geothermal. I mean, are you a one-size-fits-all approach? In other words, we should just go with the solar, as it appears that Clinton is implying? Or, in my view, and again, I'm not an expert, my sense is that there are geographical advantages, depending on where you are, to certain forms of energy. So in Hawaii, where they have really put a lot of time and energy into getting geothermal energy, that makes a lot of sense, since the islands are actually live volcanoes. Texas, wind is a good idea. Go ahead.
I just don't think that it's a good idea to say, okay, we're going to put all our apples in one cart and pick this racehorse, and this is the racehorse that's going to win. Now, solar has a lot of advantages to it, especially due to the fact that you have the broader your production base, the lower the cost of the panels. And so as adoption increases, you get an amazing return in the sense of lowering costs due to scaling production. And in addition, there's a technological component that steadily increases the efficiency of the panels, so that combined aspect makes solar very attractive. It's also one of the disadvantages for solar is the fact that it is an intermittent energy source. It's not something that can be used as what they call baseload capacity without battery storage. But the cost of batteries is falling as well, so that's another mark in solar's favor. Wind energy is fantastic; has been a low cost energy source since the mid 2000s. Cost less than coal in many cases, cost less than gas in many cases, certainly cost less than nuclear. And so wind is a fantastic resource where the wind blows. Geothermal is a good baseload capacity. There's a bit of a cost issue with geothermal, but the costs have been falling, albeit more slowly than solar or for example, wind. But I think that it's good to have a bit of baseload capacity for renewable energy source. So where you have that geothermal potential and where it's easy to tap, certainly I think that that's a fantastic idea, as they have in Hawaii and Iceland, for example. And I mean, other aspects of renewable energy that I think are worthwhile pursuing involve concentrated solar power, which actually can serve as a bit of a baseload capacity due to the fact that there's a lot of potential energy stored within the fluid medium that they heat. With concentrated solar power, it's a bit more expensive than regular solar, but it's certainly worthwhile due to the fact that you have a longer storage time. And what I am heartened by is just overall a general rapid advancement in cost reduction, to the point where renewables now are, in many markets, very competitive with fossil fuels. And the only thing holding them back from being adopted really is a kind of a political intransigence, a political resistance to it.
We have Rob Scribbler with us. That's how he writes online, the website, and I want to make sure I get it right because I'm, of course, not there. Give it to me. You tell us. What is your website again?
It's robertscribbler.com.
Robert. I've been calling you Rob, but Robert, of course, is the website. Robert, really, you learn more about global warming, about AGW there than anywhere else, and your writing is really excellent. It's outstanding. I mean, it's really, really good. Very popular site as well. And do you attribute the popularity, obviously, to your quality as a web host, you know, as the person who puts the site together, Rob, but also that people get this better than the politicians do, better than, for example, Hillary Clinton gets it?
I think that if you remove the nonsense, if you remove the political back and forth and the smoke that is being blown out by climate change deniers, and you just talk to regular people, they absolutely do get it. And in a lot of cases, you'll go to these internet forums and you'll find that the regular discussion is crowded out by people that they come in and they have a political axe to grind, or they have this particular viewpoint, which I consider to be misinformation, on the issue of both climate change and renewable energy, and they crowd out the discussion. People don't really have the opportunity to talk about their concerns or their interest in renewable energy in such a case. And what I try and do is get people involved in both, I guess what I would term as kind of a threat recognition process, where they talk about what I have experienced, as opposed, you know, when it comes to climate change, or what
just
I have
even what maybe over a 50-year lifetime, how they have noticed it gets hotter in the summer and it's not as cold in the winter. You know what, Rob, we got a break. I can't stop it. I so appreciate Robert Scribbler with us, and I hope he'll stick with me for one more segment. It's that important that we continue. Rob Scribbler, who writes at robertscribbler.com, is with us for at least another 15 minutes. And we so appreciate your time. Rob, I have been talking this morning back in California for the first time in a year. It's brown. It's just, there's like friable dirt alongside the roadways. It's a desert. And that's along the coast where it's cooler. There's been no rain in many parts of the state, or virtually no rain, no meaningful torrents in years. Is this secondary to human-caused anthropogenic global warming?
Okay, now this is a bit of a controversial issue in the sciences right now, but there is a field of study that does link the intensity and duration of the current drought in California to human-caused impacts. Now, as I said before, when you warm the climate, you increase the rate of evaporation and precipitation. That's not even it. What happens is in some places the evaporation intensity is greatly increased, and in some places the precipitation intensity is conversely increased as well. And what's been happening to California over the past couple of years is, as you've been in this under what scientists are now calling the ridiculously resilient ridge, and this is a ocean atmosphere, synergy. And what's going on is you have a great deal of warming in the Pacific Ocean going on just off the coast there. And what you're talking about is severe sea surface temperature anomalies, in some cases in the range of 4 degrees Celsius or more above what your regular sea surface temperature would be. And what that does is it creates a lot of potential heat energy in the atmosphere. It generates a ridge, a set of high pressure systems which tend to ward off the weather systems that are coming across the Pacific, especially during wintertime, which as you well know is the time for California to receive its rains. Now there's also a synergy that has been identified between this warming in the Pacific with a degree of sea ice retreat in the Arctic, and what's happened in the Arctic is that sea ice is dramatically reduced from what it was in the 1970s. And this has an influence on the jet stream. It tends to make the jet stream weaker because the temperature differential between the pole and the equator is less. And it tends to allow for the propagation of what they call Rossby waves, a very powerful waves in the jet stream which tend to get stuck. And so we see a strong ridges in some areas and strong troughs which are associated with rainfall and storminess in other areas. So what's been happening to California is you've been stuck under this persistent ridge which has been ongoing for at least 2 years now, and at the end of a period of cyclical drying, meaning that California had been drying out already before this had happened. And as a result, as of last November, you guys were experiencing your worst drought in 1,000 years, according to tree ring records. So no, it's not normal. And yes, climate change probably made this a lot worse. This drought probably would not have been anywhere near as intense without the added influence of human-caused warming, which has resulted in a degree of sea ice loss, has added more evaporation potential heat energy to the system, has increased the likelihood that water temperatures off the coast in your region would be higher. And these combined influences, Hansen talks about loading the dice. And so, I play Dungeons and Dragons. I know that's a bit geeky, but I think about it as just you add...
Let me just interrupt. It's really geeky, okay? It's not just a bit.
It's really geeky.
Go.
But if you roll a dice and you add one, then your chances are going to be different. And that's what you're dealing with in the climate system right now. You're dealing with an added factor which increases your likelihood of an extreme event like what you're seeing now. And I think that it's irresponsible for some people to say, well, you can't directly attribute this to climate change. I think what you can say and what you should say is that the environment is such that we have created the potential for these kind of events that are happening now, and the reason why we're seeing so many of them now is because of climate change.
Robert Scribler with us, robertscribler.com. He writes about environment matters, about the social and justice, economic justice matters, and we're really focusing on anthropogenic global warming with Robert Scribler in this hour. I so appreciate his time. You really got to go to that website, robertscribler.com. By the way, we had a little bit of a drop off there where we lost the feed out to you, not the interview here, but the feed out to listeners. This entire interview will be posted, may take me a bit of time because I'm not at home, but I will post the entire interview at, of course, helginsburg.com. Robert, we got a few more minutes, and I've always argued that political solutions are the only solutions to these enormous problems that we face. We talked about the various geographic advantages that various forms of energy may have, depending on where you are in this country or around the world. Clinton's solar solution, I think, is, as you say, it's much, much, much better than nothing, but it ignores the fact that, again, in West Texas, wind is the perhaps the preferred choice, will be the most efficient choice, and in other forms of parts of the country where there isn't much sun, say the Pacific Northwest, again, solar may not be the ideal option. So what do you think about my proposal, which has always been, let's just tax the heck out of all fossil fuels and just keep taxing them at the consumer level? Because it's when you burn the oil, when you burn the natural gas, when you burn the coal, that we create the problem. So whoever burns it should pay for it through a much, much higher consumption tax, and then return that money. You know, it's going to hurt poor people. It's going to hurt middle-income people to tax their energy. So return that money to them in the form of capital, in the form of cash. Then they can choose a cheaper form of energy, than almost, and they invariably will do so. Your thoughts?
I think that that's the most socially responsible policy when you talk about monetary policy as a result or as a response to climate change. Your idea is has been supported in another iteration by James Hansen, who has a fee and dividend kind of approach, which is essentially a tax and then subsidy, similar to what you're saying. And my opinion is that that is a very effective response to climate change, because it incentivizes the transition away from fossil fuels. It doesn't pick winners and losers as far as non-carbon energy sources, so they get a chance to duke it out in the markets. And it creates a kind of a sin tax on fossil fuels, which in my opinion, due to the terrible impact of their externalities, is long overdue. So my opinion is that this is a much better way of dealing with things than, say, for example, purely market-based solutions, which would be kind of cap and trade. But in another way, it's a very elegant solution, because it does leverage the effectiveness of markets.
Right, because, you know, and I'm glad you said that, because I, like you, perceive myself as fighting for economic justice, and that doesn't mean I don't believe that we completely reject market economies or even capitalism. It means we need to regulate our economic system closely if it is market-based or even capitalistic, and reduce greatly the gap, the differential between the winners and losers, and also, again, ensure that the right incentives are in place so that harmful products, harmful goods, or, you know, let's call them bads, so that we tax the bads, whether they're products that cause harm to people or services that are ultimately result in a net loss of income, a diminution in quality of life. I think that should be the proper role of government, one of the proper roles, Rob.
Well, I agree. I agree wholeheartedly with that sentiment. I think that when you look at economic systems, what do you want to do? Do you want to encourage cheating, bullying, and exploitation? If you don't have a system that punishes bad actors, that punishes products that have a negative impact, then basically what you end up with is a multiplication of cheating, bullying, and exploitation, and you end up with, well, in a lot of ways what we see now, which is an expanding income inequality, where you have more and more people that have less capability to fend for themselves. Individuals are victimized, not empowered. And you have an increasing number of monopolistic entities that have a deleterious influence overall on society and on economies as a whole.
You reward the bad actors and you punish good ones. If someone says, you know what, I want to keep my business in the United States because I've got workers who are dependent upon, I want to pay them a living wage, then unless you have the government actually tax the bad actors who take their manufacturing capacity to someplace where you can pay workers $1 an hour and dump effluent waste into the nearest stream. Unless you tax them and punish them for that decision, then you make the person who wants to do the right thing, you make it impossible for them to have a profitable business.
Well, there has to be a set of rules for the game. If there is not, then you have a lot of people have called it a race to the bottom. And I think that's a pretty apt description. You end up with destructive influences that create social stress to the point where economic systems are destabilized. And it's highly unjust to an increasing number of people. And that level of injustice has an impact. It doesn't just sit there. It doesn't
right.
just go away.
Such a good point. It really has real-world effects on human beings and terrible effects on them. Rob, we only have 2 more minutes. I have a question for you. Are you more troubled by Hillary Rodham Clinton's refusal to state whether she's in favor of or opposed to the Keystone Pipeline and her refusal to state whether she supports or opposes the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which she, her State Department, helped draft? Are you more troubled by that than you are heartened by her rather vague, aspirational, grandiose plan for universal solar energy and by 2027?
I'll say that talk is easy. It's easy to say that she wants to have this grandiose plan. Actions speak louder than words. If you have supported the Trans-Pacific Partnership in the past, I that is, to me, a big strike against her. And her failure to speak out on climate change on the Keystone Pipeline itself is to me, a very disturbing choice. At the very least, it's a calculated political choice because she doesn't want to get too much flack from the fossil fuel industry. And I find that to be not encouraging.
Thanks so much, Rob Scribler, robertscribler.com, the website. I will have the entire interview at the website. We'll be back. I'm hoping to get Solar Czar on the air for the final segment.